I am a cancer survivor. I start my workshops by saying that because for so many years, well, not so many, but for 2 years, almost 2 full years, I was so ashamed of the word cancer and its connotations that I couldn't talk about it at all. It was as though I was shut up in a little prison. I didn't want my friends to know unless they were really close friends. I didn't want my family to know. I didn't want the people on my job to know. And when they asked me, I told them I wasn't ready to talk about it yet. And so I listened to people doing the 12-step program, and I noticed that the way they would begin their talks was to name themselves and then say what was wrong, you know. For example, if I were an alcoholic, I would stand up and say, "My name is Andrew Powell. I am an alcoholic." And so I said, well, maybe if I could just adopt that principle and use it, that I could get rid of some of the shame that I was feeling around the disease. So when I did break out of my prison, so to speak, I've been talking about the disease ever since in ways that would help bring more information to other people and sharing my experience of the disease and also my experience of survivorship so that they could see that there is life beyond cancer for many people, especially if the disease is detected early. So yesterday we talked about the physical and emotional dimensions of disease. Welcome, I'm glad to have a man among us. I thought we had scared you all away yesterday. But today we're talking about breathing life into ourselves and how do we do that in the context of illness and especially of breast cancer. Of cancer, period, not breast, but just cancer. So I want to start by talking about how I really came to this point. Yesterday I told you about my experience of uterine and breast cancer, and but there was something more than that, just that experience that got me to being interested in doing workshops, and especially workshops that try to be inclusive of both males and females. And what happened was, after I learned about this, that this fibrocystic disease just wasn't going to go away, and kept having to have constant biopsies, and the breast had, I told you that I had very small breasts in the first place, so I brought this little model to kind of use as a diagram of my breasts. you know, but the thing is, what I'm trying to stress is the fact that just because it's small doesn't mean that it wasn't important to me. So anyway, I want you to just to visualize a small breast, maybe not quite this small, but a small breast that has had 5 biopsies. So that's 5 little pieces of tissue taken out. And you could tell, I could just seem like I could tell where every one came out, you know, because there was a scar for one thing, small scar. There was scar tissue that built up, secondly. And the breast was just deformed. It looked deformed, you know. Now, someone with larger breasts could have that many biopsies and not even miss it.
Yeah.
But I couldn't. And it was really bothersome. But what was most bothersome was the fact that I could not tell whether or not there was cancer present by external examination. And I didn't know whether it was scar tissue or cyst or what it was. And each time I went to the clinic, the doctors had to give me another mammogram or do another mammogram where they would inject the breast was dyed and drew the mammogram while the syringe was still there. I'll never forget that because it was frightening. But anyhow, when I decided that I would have breast reconstruction, I was in relationship with the young man because my husband and I were divorced, so I didn't have to go through what it would be like to come home at night, sleep with the man, you know, and didn't have one of my breasts. That was not one of my problems. It is for a lot of women who are in relationship or in marriages or whatever, but it wasn't for me at that time. But now I've met this fine man that I really cared a lot about, and we had talked about a relationship. And so I started having all of these unhealthy feelings about who I was as a woman. I told you yesterday that I had the fibroids on the uterus, and I was thinking about a hysterectomy. And so all of that just came into sharp focus for me. And so I began to question God about my womanhood and ask questions like, what is it that makes me a woman? And I would say, now God, suppose I do have the hysterectomy, and suppose I already had one breast removed, suppose I have to have the other breast removed, will I still be a woman? You know, what is it that makes me a woman? And then the other thing that troubled me a great deal was the prospect of being in relationship and in a sexual kind of relationship, was how would I be perceived by my friend? You know, would he be accepting of me without my breast? Or if I did have to have the hysterectomy, what would that mean to him? And I started just feeling like, gee, you know, he's such a nice guy. And this is just not even fair. He ought to have a woman with two breasts and with a uterus and all sorts of really self-devaluation. And so I started to praying about how I was feeling about myself and still asking God these questions that troubled me so much. And finally one day I was in my closet, literally in my closet, the walk-in closet, and the voice came back to me that I was not a woman because of these parts of my body, but because of something intrinsic that God had done. And so, gee, that was powerful. I was glad to get that affirmation. But then I started wanting to know how God would feel about the reconstruction. You know, God has given us all these parts. Shouldn't we be satisfied with them? And so forth and so on. How dare we try to improve on God's creation? A lot of other troubling thoughts. So I prayed about that too. And then I was referred, I mean, the strong impression that came to me was take a look back at Genesis, you know, the story of creation and how God had created males and females and put human beings in charge, so to speak, of creation, which means that we are managers of a sort, and that we can make decisions about things that we think would enrich our lives. And so then I reflected on people who had other types of prosthesis, like an artificial leg. I told you I worked at Memorial Sloan Kettering Institute, and I had seen people with artificial noses and, you know, artificial penises and so forth and so on. And so I just determined for myself that it was my decision. If I thought that this was for me, you know, the breast reconstruction was for me, then I should feel comfortable to do that for me because I'm the manager over my life and I have the right to make that decision. Other women, of course, have the right to make their own decision too, even if it's different from mine. And so I felt real good about that, but I was still troubled by how this prospective mate or partner would respond to me sexually if I had breast reconstruction. And then it just seemed like the Spirit of God just got busy with me and showed me how ridiculous I was being. qualities that I could point out in him, and I did it. I just sat down and started listening. All the good things that attracted me to this man. And most of it had to do with inner qualities, not outward appearance. And I said to myself, shoot, I have all of these qualities too. Everyone that I had listed in, you know, as something attractive in him was in me too. And I said, well, wait a minute. What if he doesn't want to be bothered with me? I said, now I'm a pretty nice person. And after counting my own qualities or at least trying to evaluate myself in a more positive light, I say, well, if he doesn't want me, then it's his loss. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just his loss. If he is so callous or superficial in his thinking that he will only look at my external beauty and not what's within and what I have to offer, then it's really his loss. Too bad. God told me I'm a woman now. So I'm feeling real good about that. Doesn't matter whether I have two breasts, a vagina, or a uterus, or two legs, riding or walking. You know, I'm still a woman. And so I was satisfied with that, and I decided that I would have the breast reconstruction because that was what I wanted to do. That was my decision. But while I was in the hospital, I mean, I had talked to him about it, and he was in, do what you think, you know, whatever you think will make you happy, that's what you ought to do. I will be there to support you, and all that sounded real good. You know, I was happy. But when I had the surgery, it was different. He disappeared completely, you know, just had the total feeling of complete abandonment. And I remember lying in my bed, my hospital bed, with hemostats on both sides and an enormous amount of pain because I had this, the left breast removed and reconstructed at the same time. And the right breast, the surgery had been done 2 years earlier. So I had both breasts reconstructed at the same time, so there was really nowhere to turn. You know, and I remember having the physical kind of pain that I endured. But my doctor would come in and give me an injection of morphine. And some of the physical pain would be relieved. But I tell you the truth, the kind of pain that was in my heart just could not be compared to the physical pain. And then the other part of that was there was nothing that gave me any immediate relief. And so, I started thinking about what women who have been married to their husbands for 15 or 20 years must experience when the husband is not there for them. And, you know, our relationship wasn't even started. Or, you know, we were just at the talking stage about what could be. But, and I said, now, if I'm hurting like this, what must that pain be like for them? And I resolved in my heart and mind that when I got better, not if, but when I got better, I would try to do something to help people, help women in particular, to feel better about themselves before there's any experience of cancer, just to help us to feel better about ourselves, especially since womanhood in our culture has been either elevated so high that we could not live up to it or devalued so low that we didn't want to be connected with it. And so I thought about how to do that in the context of my own experience of cancer. And that's how I started doing research and educating myself more by being affiliated with the American Cancer Society, with other healthcare agencies that provided not only care, but a tremendous amount of literature as well, so that I could help others become more informed. And then the part about the community, see, I was so hurt by this abandonment that my focus primarily was on the women at first. And then said, well, I need to look at this. What was the reason that he fled or he abandoned me? What was that all about? I didn't want to just have to make different kinds of assumptions. I wanted to talk to him and know why he wasn't there for me after he said he would be. And we had a conversation about it. I did it as an interview because it was part of my research. And I think also I was kind of scared of what some of his answers would be still, even though, you know, no relationship ever developed. And I found out that there was a lot of fear on his part. Men are usually, supposed to be very strong. That's what you think anyway. But when it comes to disease, serious illness, terminal illness, anything that's life-threatening, many ministers have problems going into the hospital to even visit the sick. And when they do, they often don't feel comfortable to name the disease, especially if it's a disease that women usually get and men don't. Like, I won't say breast cancer because men do get that, but like cancer of the uterus or, you know, some organs that men don't have. And so I decided that if I really wanted to get anywhere with this, I needed to develop my workshops in a way that I could try to bring us together as a community of people and to look at disease not as a woman's disease or a man's disease, but as a human disease. For example, these pamphlets that I have today say for men only. I would never put out a pamphlet like this because it's excluding the female population. Mm-hmm. And others that might say for females only, I wouldn't encourage that kind of conversation because it discourages us from coming together as men and women to talk about how disease affects us either directly or indirectly. Now, there's not a woman who has breast cancer or uterine cancer or any other type of cancer who is not in relationship with a man in some way, whether it's your father, your brother, your son, your husband, or whomever, an uncle. But some man is there, you know, in that family who ought to be concerned about you. And the same is true with women. The disease that men have, like testicular cancer or prostate cancer, affects us either directly or indirectly. And the best example I can give is when we have sons. You know, there are ways in which we interact with their sons, with our sons as babies and with young boys that requires us to know a certain amount about at least testicular cancer so that we can know what the warning signs are and call this to the attention of the doctor if it has not already been noticed and that sort of thing. And so I think that it is very important for us as men and women, especially as church men and church women, to come together and talk about sexuality, talk about disease, and talk about the way in which we can relate to one another that would help us to breathe life into ourselves rather than having to suffer in isolation. Some women don't have a chance to talk about what's bothering them. Some men don't have a chance to talk about what's bothering them if they have cancer or if they have AIDS. I mean, it's just too painful for us to hear. And when we don't give them the space to communicate that pain, when we won't be there to feel with them, to enter into that pain in some kind of way, then we silence them. And that's oppressive. There are two, essentially, there are two communities We have a community of the sick and a community of the well. And sometimes it seems like the well people feel like they're going to get contaminated if they step over into the sick community. That's where we are with the AIDS issue. We want to stay as far away from it as we possibly can. And when we do that, we are not there for our loved ones, so that if they are seriously ill, they are much likely to die sooner without our being there to support them than they are if we are there showing them love and trying to understand the disease and to know how we can help them. Studies have been done that prove that children with serious illnesses who received loving care and attention frequently thrived much better and much longer than ones who just has the medical staff to come and pick them up occasionally and just take care of their health needs. You need all of that. You need, you know, all of it working together to help the individual to thrive. And so I decided that if I just address issues that relate primarily to women and not to men too, then I was going to be missing an opportunity to try to get us to bond together and to open up and talk to one another. And I know that's hard because we haven't always done it. It's easier for some than it is for others, but it's extremely hard for some too, because you don't want to put your stuff out there with men in the room not knowing how they're going to perceive you or interpret what you're saying and so forth, and vice versa. So I think the only way to break down some of those barriers is for us to start asking each other questions, and whether or not we feel comfortable to do that here, it's still a beginning if we haven't done it already. But that's how I came to be involved in doing this type of work. So in addressing health issues that related primarily to women on yesterday with the breast and uterine cancer, I thought it would be appropriate to talk today about types of cancer that both men and women get, you know, like lung cancer, and also to talk about prostate and testicular cancer as well, because we are all involved in it. And I passed around the breast models on yesterday so that you could see what the lump actually feels like by doing the breast examination, using the pads of the three fingers and going clockwise around the breast, moving in just a bit each time, and looking for any unusual dimpling or reddening or discoloration of any kind of the breast, or an inverted nipple, or anything that's unusual for you. And I even encourage the men who have a history of cancer in your families not to be afraid or ashamed to check yourself out when you're taking your showers. And also to know how your breasts look, so that if there is something wrong, you would be able to detect it early, because men usually don't find out that they have cancer until it's way in the advanced stages, and then it's too far gone to save their lives. And so to me, this seems like a simple precaution, rather than being in that minority that has no chance of survival, or at least your chances are severely reduced. And so today, I have a model of the testicles, and for those of you who feel comfortable to do so, you can examine them and see if you can find a lump in there. I don't want to make anyone feel uncomfortable in doing my presentation, but I do think it's important for us to know certain things, to have certain information. And until we open ourselves to at least examining the model, you know, we just might never know what it would feel like in our male partner, or in our sons, or whomever. So anyway, I wanted to start out by talking a little bit about lung cancer, because, and the reason I chose lung, you know, there's so many types of cancer, it's difficult to know where to start. Somebody said to me, well, you ought to be sure to talk about skin cancer, but then she didn't send me any literature on skin cancer. Mm-hmm. You know, and I don't want to talk about it and not be able to give you some resources so that you can look at it, read it for yourself and know where to go for further information. So I decided that I would address lung cancer because it's one of the main killers around now. For over 40 years, breast cancer claimed the lives of more women than any other cancer-related death. But since 1987, lung cancer has been the major cancer death in women. And lots of, you know, many of us don't know that. But it's also a major killer in men too. But more women die from lung cancer since 1987 than men. And so we need to be aware of that so we can know how to take care of ourselves. And some of the risk factors are cigarette smoking, you know, that's usually considered number one, and a history of smoking for 20 years or more especially creates a greater risk. They say, they being the American Cancer Society and the National Cancer Institute and other organizations that do this type of research, say that exposure to certain industrial substances such as arsenic, asbestos, or exposure from occupational, medical, and environmental sources increase the risk factors too. Now, I was just over at Chuck Kunert's session a little while ago, and I heard him talking about how many agents have been designated, so to speak, as cancer-causing agents. But he also went on to explain that even though there is a risk, it's so minute or so small that you would have to use certain products in a quantity that we're not likely to use it in that great amount that it would be able to cause cancer in us. But nevertheless, I think we need to take seriously the warning signals that, not the warning signal, but the risk factors that have already been identified, because persons who did contract cancer were in some of these conditions, and they think that it might have played a role, regardless of how small. If it played a role, then you don't want to expose yourself unnecessarily. Some of the warning signals that we are cautioned to watch for are persistent cough, sputum streaked with blood, chest pain, recurring pneumonia or bronchitis. And you know that some people have a smoker's cough from smoking so much, and we'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. But because we get so many colds and we have so many allergies, and some of us have asthma, you know, I had asthma for over 20 years, that you don't know always what's going on. And so it's good to have a chest x-ray done annually anyway, just to make sure that your lungs are healthy. But if you have any of these symptoms, you would want to bring that to the attention of your doctor as well. Lung cancer is another one that's usually discovered in its more advanced stages. And so it's very difficult to turn it around or to cure it once it's in the advanced stages. We are better now at it than we were when I was working at Memorial Sloan Kettering Institute. Then, I mean, there was just a pattern. If a woman came in with advanced breast cancer, the cancer seemed like it had that it would take. It would often metastasize to the uterus, to the lung, and to the brain. And once it got in the lung, you could tell it because of the way the person coughed and the labored breathing and all of that. And when it got to the brain, you could also tell that because the person would be at first just slightly disoriented. And then as the disease continued to progress, the person would just be totally out of it and not in touch with reality. And so if we could just take these little simple precautions and anything unusual at all, no matter how small, if it causes you concern, then as I said on yesterday, we need to check it out with our physicians. The treatment options are usually a surgery, radiation therapy, and chemotherapy. So these pamphlets that I have here will help us to understand it even better. And also to help us, give us a chance to see what a normal lung looks like. I like the ones, the pamphlets with the pictures, so they help us to see what a normal lung looks like and how it looks when we have emphysema, how it looks when we have cancer. And we can see how the cancer ravages the lung with what they call an army of wildly multiplying cells, and how the constant the cigarette smoke just would irritate the bronchi. And then as the disease progresses, if you look at the second paragraph, you see that under the onslaught of this irritation, the hair-like cilia, which filter the air we breathe, disappear, and the body tries to compensate by producing more mucus. But this mucus itself becomes a problem for us. And so this mucus gets trapped in our lungs and we can't expel it as easily unless we, you know, stop smoking or stop doing some of whatever it was that caused that irritation in the first place. And so in the latter stages of lung cancer, the abnormal cells just break away from the lung and are carried throughout the lymphatic system. You know, and that's when they attack other vital organs of the body. Yes.
I've heard various figures on if you quit smoking, your lungs return to normal between a certain period of time.
Yeah, I think that says, it says so here too. It says so in the next to the last paragraph, if a smoker quits before cancerous lesions are present.
No, but what I'm talking about is I've heard like 1 month, 3 months, a year, and your lung tissue is normal again. It's nice and clean again.
Well, they might do that because the body tries to heal itself.
Right.
If we will allow it to do that.
But so, you don't know the time period. That's what I was saying.
No, I don't know the time period. Some other literature may give that.
I know it's less. I mean, a year or less. I know that.
Yeah.
But I just
some of the damage is
irreversible.
Some of the damage is irreversible.
Yeah.
Just from the
smoking. Yeah.
Right. Even if they haven't developed emphysema or cancer yet, I don't know the extent that a body just died of cancer.
But it still is a good thing if you are a smoker to pay attention. Now, one of the women I've worked with from Cancer Care, Robin Earls, stresses the fact that even though we use smoking as the number one cancer-causing agent or factor, she said we have to take into consideration the fact that some people smoke all their lives and never get cancer, never get anything else except maybe a nicotine habit, you know. And so she says that it's important to realize that not everybody who smokes is going to get cancer. But if we want to reduce the likelihood of getting it, if we want to reduce the risk factor involved, then we should pay attention to the no smoking that the cancer researchers are suggesting. And so, I'm not quite sure how I'm gonna move on with this. I kinda wanna get it all out here and then let's talk about it. But if you do have a pressing question or something that you think needs to be said, feel free to do that. More information to give, then feel free to do that, because we can all do it better together than I can do it by myself. So if we talk, I'm gonna talk about testicular cancer just for a couple of minutes too. Because we find in doing our workshops, talking to different men, that there is a fear among men about getting testicular and prostate cancer. And that fear often has to do with their ability to reproduce, and with their ability to be sexually active, and that sort of thing. And in the same way that we have so many stereotypes going against women, and the way we objectify women and talk about us as a conglomeration of bodily parts, we often do that to men too. And men will tell other men, for example, if a man wants to hurt another man, the first thing he'll tell him is he has no balls, you know, and that sort of thing. And that makes a man feel bad. And so we have to watch how we talk to each other. You know, all of these things are important in our own self-image. And so if someone is frightened or unwilling to take a risk that perhaps you feel more comfortable to take, that's no reason to say the person has no balls or no guts or no whatever it is. But with men, it usually is said that they have no balls. And so that kind of a self-image has an impact on a man when he has testicular cancer, you know? And many men would, used to be, I hope that we are more informed now and making different decisions. But when I was at Memorial Sloan Kettering, which was back in the 1960s, some of those men would refuse to have surgery if they had cancer of the penis or testicular cancer, because they did not want to interfere with their sexual organs. And so again, we see the correlation between women's breasts, women's uteri, and our wanting to hold on to these things that we think make us feminine, and the male's self-image and wanting to hold on to things that they think make them masculine. And so, you know, we have to work together to just dispel this kind of error, because it's not our sexual organs only that make us who we are. I mean, they are a part of all who we are, but we have to recognize that they are parts of the whole and not the whole itself. And that even without them, we would still be who we are as persons, as human persons, because we are who God made us. And so, anyway, in talking about cancer of the testes, the male reproductive glands, is one of the most common cancers in men 15 to 34 years old. And it accounts for 3% of all cancer deaths in this group. But if it's discovered in the early stages, it can be treated and the treatment will be effective. So, I mean, that's the bright side. That is the bright side. So the whole emphasis is on early detection. If not, then we're not going to get there. I mean, even if you catch a cold, if you start to treat it as soon as you start sniffling and carrying on, you are much more likely to knock it right out than if you just let, oh, I feel like I'm coming down with a cold and don't do anything about it. And it's the same principle that's operative in cancer detection. If we detect it early, there's a good possibility that the treatment options will be effective and we can live long and healthy lives. Now, the American Cancer Society said that the major risk factor in men is that of an undescended or a partially descended testicle. And that means when the scrotum, when it does not go down in the sac, you know. And I didn't know what this was at the time, but I remember my younger brother had that problem. And he had to have minor surgery in order to get the testicle in the sac properly, you know. And it was a simple procedure. He was a baby, and the surgery was performed while he was a baby. So he didn't display any particular discomfort, long-term discomfort as a result of it. But, and I'm thinking to myself, as I said earlier, that if we don't know this, when we have our boy children and we see that this is the case, we won't know what to do, and we also won't know the risk factor involved if we don't take some kind of action. So that's what makes it important to me for women and men to have this kind of information. And the first sign of testicular cancer is usually a slight enlargement of the testicles and any change in the consistency. And you can see, did I pass out these? I didn't pass out these yet, did I? Let me pass these out so I won't be talking and you can't follow me by looking at the ticklers that have here. See, you will see the diagram that shows you how to do the testicular exam. And of course, men can do this examination when they're in the shower. That's usually very effective. And they don't have to go through the same kind of procedures that we do in doing the breast self-examination. So, and it only takes what, I think they say about 3 minutes. Whereas our exams, we have to examine both breasts, and that's going to take you a good 10 or 15 minutes if you do it carefully. So it's very important that this examination is not neglected, especially in men within this age group. So this is the model of the testicles, and I'm going to give it to the gentleman and ask you just to use that technique in trying to locate any abnormality within there that feels foreign, like it doesn't belong, and then to pass it along to the ladies in the room who feel comfortable to do it. And please don't do it if you don't feel comfortable to. So it's just really very important to make sure that when you go to the doctor, that, you know, the doctor does this kind of exam, you know, the clinical testicle exam, just like we would have the doctor do our clinical breast exam. And oftentimes, males feel very uncomfortable with female doctors performing this examination. I have a friend who is in the hospital now, and he tells me how uncomfortable it is for him when the female nurses come in and have to examine his genitalia. Mm-hmm. And so it is uncomfortable, I suppose, for men, just as it is for us with male doctors, you know, doing vaginal exams on us and even doing the breast exams sometimes. But it's, despite the little bit of discomfort, it's more important to bear that for a moment and to realize that this person is acting in a professional role and have it done than it is to let the fact of gender itself cause us not to take advantage of a good examination that we need for our own prolonged health and life. And so I just want to make that clear. Sometimes after following through with a good physical examination, the doctor may perform certain x-rays to make a more accurate diagnosis. And so we need to be aware in the beginning that this is something that may happen. It's not intended to frighten you, but to inform you so that you can be in better command of your own health. And with the prostate cancer, the prostate is a gland just below the bladder in the male genital tract. Might as well pass these out so that you could follow along again. So just pass that along.
Yeah, Annie, I wanted to say something that's really obvious, and yet I think sometimes we don't think about it in terms of discomfort with being examined by somebody of the opposite sex. I think so often we give so much of our power over to the medical establishment that we don't consider the fact we could ask for a different physician to do that examination. I mean, even though I do go to a female doctor now. I think if my primary doctor were a male and I were uncomfortable with that at this point in my life, I would probably say, I'm uncomfortable with this.
Yeah.
I'd like to see one of your colleagues.
Yeah. Well, that works better when you're in, it depends on how many steps you want to go through to get it done. If you're, doctor's in private practice and there's only one, he's the only one in his office, or she's the only one in her office, then that might mean a referral or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But that's appropriate. If that's what you want to do, you do need to take advantage of the power you have.
And I think we need to respect that.
I
don't think anybody now would say, well, that's inappropriate, or, you know, a few years ago they might have. But.
Yeah, that's true. That's very true. But we ought to do that. If the level of discomfort is too great, that we just don't want this person to do it because we feel so uncomfortable, then the solution is what she suggested, to ask for another gender.
And I think there's good reason for that, because even though you might go through with the exam, if you're uncomfortable, you might not ask all the right questions.
That's
or
true.
Hear what you should hear, because if you're real nervous, you just don't hear and digest real well.
Yes, that's very true. You know, from a personal experience. So, the same thing is true with the prostate cancer. This pamphlet says that the is the second highest incidence of cancer in men, next to skin cancer. And that's something to think about. And look at these figures here. Prostate cancer will be found in an estimated 165,000 men each year, most of them over age 65. An estimated 35,000 men will die of the disease each year. And I mean, this is a disease that seems to affect senior men in their senior years. So we need to talk to them about it. I mean, a lot of times, sometimes we didn't come up, we weren't brought up to be health conscious. And even though we are aware that there is such a thing as prostate cancer, men may often feel, well, it's not going to happen to me. And so we neglect to do the kind of care that we could do if we were more health conscious. And in this case, it means making sure that if there are any symptoms at all, that, you know, we would have ourselves checked by a doctor. And another thing that I am reading now, and hearing now a lot, is that sometimes, I mean, the testicles being on the outside, you can check them much easier, you know, and so the symptoms are much more obvious if there's a lump or something there. But prostate gland is not the same, so you have to really pay attention to the symptoms. And this, we ask the question, what are the symptoms? It usually involves an enlargement of the gland. And while this enlargement should be investigated, it doesn't mean that you have cancer. It's just like with women. You know, we get so scared about the lumps that we often don't want to take any action because we're scared it's going to be cancer. But most of the lumps and bumps and bruises that we find are not cancerous. And so we can't let that fear just immobilize us and stop us from taking the right kind of actions to safeguard our help. And it could be the prostate enlargement can lead to a variety of urinary problems, difficulty in urinating, the need to urinate frequently, painful or burning urination, burning during urination, or blood in the urine. And so we need to be aware that if we have any of these conditions, or we see that hear our spouses or other males in the family talking about these kinds of symptoms, we need to tell them, okay, perhaps it would be a good idea for you to go and be checked by a doctor. And again, in doing the digital rectal exam, many men and women feel uncomfortable with somebody sticking their fingers up your behind. Just is not a good feeling, you know? You don't do that yourself unless you happen to be so constipated that you figure you give it a shot to try to unpack yourself. But, desperate measures.
They always get the woman to do that too.
See? Yeah, that's what they say. But, if we feel uncomfortable about having it done, then we can just ask for another doctor to do it. If it's a male, and we don't want the male, women don't want the male, then ask for a female and vice versa, so that we will still go on and have the examination, because that's what's really important. And the treatment options are surgery, hormone treatments, radiation, or anti-cancer drugs. And the choice is the recommendation of your doctor will usually be based upon how advanced they think the disease is. And so it's just very, very important for us to take good care of all of our organs, of our bodies. Yes,
in the back. Also the test, the PSA test, you know about that?
I'm sorry, I can't hear you.
The PSA test that they do on men is very important now for picking it up earlier.
Okay, could you elaborate on it a little bit?
I don't know a whole lot about it. I just know I made sure my husband asked for one last.
That's right. It's in the brochure.
Okay.
Okay.
The antigen blood, prostate-specific antigen blood testing?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. Oh yes, that's the other option to that, or not other option, but additional testing that can be done in order to detect the cancer earlier. So I want to stop here. Where is our model?
It's on the table.
Okay. Did all of you who wanted to examine it, did you find the lump?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
On several. Oh, did. Oh, good.
Yeah, sure. Good. Four?
No. Well, I don't know how many are in there. This is not my model. This is a bad group. I'm gonna be strange, but this model came from the American Cancer Society in Wenatchee. Mm-hmm. So I didn't really have a chance to go through it as much as I've gone through breast models to find out how many lumps there were in there. I just made sure there were lumps in there so that you could have a sense of what that feels like. But so anyway, let's open it up for a little discussion and talk about ways. This is how I really would like to end our session, if we could just among ourselves decide this question. How do we breathe life into ourselves? And you notice that I capitalized the O in ourselves, because I want us to think of ourselves collectively rather than one individual in a group, you know, of several other persons. And talk about that in the context of these issues, health issues that we have discussed today. Anybody have any questions or additional information that you want to add to what has been said, first of all?
I have something. You were talking about abandonment when you discover you have a terminal illness and someone close to you recedes from you.
Yes.
My sensitivity is through a father who recently died of cancer. And they live in the Midwest and I out on the West Coast. So granted, my caregiving and my father was periodic, you know, on Vincent's back. But my mother had an inability to be a caregiver because of factors in her relationship to my father. My father was a very independent man who took extremely good care of himself and was very proud of that. Mm-hmm. And he was, well, I don't need to add other factors, but because of that, that affected their relationship. They had a very good, loving, warm relationship, but when he became very ill, it was hard for my mother to take care of my father as he became more debilitated. And so there were two levels of care that came in to help her. First of all, when I or my brothers came back, we were able to do more than she on that particular level. Mm-hmm. And then caregivers who were just people they hadn't known before could take care of those needs even better than we could. Mm-hmm. And what I'm saying is sometimes when you're in those situations, you do abandon part of your relationship, and it's okay. It's all right. We needed to tell my mother that was all right. Because of the relationship, the history she had with my father, that was okay at this time. She couldn't do that. But there were other people who could step in and do it. And I think we, as we breathe life into ourselves, we need to know. I was also surprised, and I'm sure those
need to know. Don't stop that thought. I'm going to write it down. We need to know.
Well, we need to know that sometimes if we're sensitized to certain situations, we may even have to help people we wouldn't normally help. I'm sure you've had this experience too, that sometimes people you don't expect to come to you in your moments of crises, particularly if they're physical crises, come to you and you're not even ready for them to be there, and they come and fit that role. Mm-hmm. And so, I don't know, I guess I'm getting blathering here, but I don't want my mother to feel guilty that she wasn't able to do that at that time. She may be able to do it for someone else later.
And I think what you're pointing out, in a family context, you're pointing out the importance of the community, because some people in the community will have more strength in that area, will be more comfortable in listening and helping in those roles, whereas others in the community may be more comfortable praying and supporting. Mm-hmm. Supporting the supporters, maybe.
Okay. All right. I think those are two excellent points that are interrelated, because we do have to know what we can do and what we cannot do and where we need to get professional help. The fact of the matter is, unless you have 24-hour nurses or other medical staff, there is still going to be plenty of time in which your mother still will have to interact with your father. And the strength that she may be able to give to him may not necessarily be directly involved with his physical care, or the, you know, the changing of dressings. I don't know what the nature of his disease was, but I'm just saying that some people can do that and some people cannot do that. And we have to know what our limitations are, but still find ways to be there for the loved one and to be supportive of them, so that they know that we are there and they can still draw from the strength that we can give them.
This is one of the reasons why hospice is so very, very important. Because there, when the caregiver who has reached, shall we say, the plateau where they are just completely worn out, that they can't do anymore, or that psychologically they feel that they are now ineffective, to go to a hospice group and have them move in and give the support. Sometimes you're the support not only to the person who is ill, you're just as big a support to the person who has been the caregiver.
Yes.
To help them realize that, let go, this is okay. That's why we're here, to help you over this particular thing. But
right.
You're still there showing me the love and the concern.
So feel guilty if you have to give up that.
It's another way of saying the same thing we have here, which is to really take advantage of your resources.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we're saying. That's another way of breathing life into ourselves. Because if you drain yourself...